This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yisu Heap. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
anti-government protests broke out Friday in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions. The demonstrators echoed calls from separatist groups for Cameroon's southwest and northwest to break away from French-speaking regions and form their own state.
That's Moki Edwin Kenzeka reporting from Cameroon's southwestern town of Ikona. Details next.
Also in Kenya, the same institution responsible for the failures in August presidential poll is expected to organize a fresh vote in fewer than 5 weeks. And President Donald Trump's travel ban on people from six mostly Muslim countries ends Sunday, and it's not clear what the administration's next step will be.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Anti-government protests broke out today in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions. The demonstrators echoed calls from separatist groups for Cameroon's southwest and northwest to break away from French-speaking regions and form their own state. Reporting from the southwestern town of Ikona, Moki Edwin Kenzeka has the latest.
Hundreds of youths ran through the streets of Ikona on Friday, cheering and waving palm fronds. They sang songs and carried signboards demanding independence. VOA received reports of youths holding similar protests in other parts of Cameroon's English-speaking regions. Meanwhile, local media reported an explosion in the economic capital of Douala. The explosion followed a bombing in the northwestern town of Bamenda on Thursday that left three policemen seriously injured. No one has claimed responsibility for either incident, but suspicion is falling on a movement that calls itself the Liberation Front for English-speaking Cameroon. Groups that say they are part of the movement have claimed responsibility for burning down schools in the northwest over the past 2 weeks. The governor of the northwest region, Adolphe Lelelafrik Debenchofo, told VOA the perpetrators are believed to have triggered Thursday's bombing using a mobile phone.
We have witnessed a terrorist act in Bamenda targeting the symbol of the state, that are the police that were doing their job. As a result of that, we are going to step up our security device to face that new situation.
Anglophone teachers and lawyers went on strike in the northwest and southwest in November, demanding reforms to address the predominance of French in the bilingual country. However, calls for full independence soon eclipsed those original demands amid a government crackdown. Militant separatist groups have been going around hoisting the blue and white flag of a new nation they call Ambazonia.
Gloria Caps!
VOA watched as youth raised the flag in the northwestern town of Kumbo on September 18. A man addressed the group. He looked to be in his 30s and wearing dark military attire, but declined to give his name. He said he was an area leader in the Liberation Front.
This is a town that we are bound never to enter. And today, I want to tell each and every one of you, Ambazonia is a free state.
Earlier this month, President Paul Biya ordered the release of 55 strike detainees in a bid to reopen dialogue and defuse the growing tensions. However, the president has said he will engage in no talks that threaten national unity. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Ikona, southwestern Cameroon.
Kenya is in uncharted territory as the same institution responsible for the failures in August presidential poll is expected to organize a fresh vote in fewer than 5 weeks. Briefing reporters today, the Attorney General sought to stave off fears of an impending constitutional crisis. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's opposition has given the Director of Public Prosecutions 3 days to file charges against Electoral Commission officials accused of bungling the August presidential vote. The results of that poll were nullified by the Supreme Court. Opposition Member of Parliament Godfrey Osotsi says his party cannot allow the same officials to conduct the rerun election, now scheduled for October 26th.
We are going to provide evidence from our ICT people and from our lawyers to support our case, because these elections cannot be free if those individuals are still going to preside over fresh election.
This kind of demand has made legal experts worried about a constitutional crisis if the Electoral Commission fails to hold the new election within the required 60 days of the Supreme Court's September 1st ruling. Attorney General Githu Muigai said Friday there will be no crisis.
Even in the very unlikely event that for whatever reason the election wasn't held on the 60th day, that does not delegitimize the constitutional order of the day. And in many countries, there have been various methods of expanding the time within which something is to be done.
Some legal professionals argue that if the October 31st deadline is missed, President Uhuru Kenyatta will have to make way for a caretaker administration. Muigai disagrees.
To establish any form of government other than in compliance with this constitution is declared by the constitution unlawful. There is no government known to the constitution of Kenya called a transitional government or a caretaker government or any other form of government other than that is defined in this constitution.
Kenyans are divided over the court's decision to throw out the presidential results. The court said electronically transmitted results released by the Electoral Commission were neither transparent nor verifiable, as required by law. The ruling Jubilee Party says the court failed to consider the voters and the final result, which showed Kenyatta winning by 1.4 million votes. Constitutional expert Nelson Harvey says the court focused on the electoral process.
What the Constitution wanted to achieve was to have a very simplistic process where the common man will be in a position to understand how a determination as to who has won the election was arrived at. It was meant to be as simple and as straightforward that everybody will understand.
The voiding of the presidential vote has sparked appeals for the courts to nullify other results from the August general elections. More than 300 lawsuits have been filed so far, mostly by candidates who lost their bid for office. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The International Organization for Migration says it has voluntarily repatriated 1,666 Burundian refugees in Tanzania over the past 2 weeks. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
More than 400,000 Burundian refugees have fled to 8 neighboring countries since violence surged in Burundi in 2015. The International Organization for Migration says the bulk of the refugees, nearly 280,000, went to Tanzania. It says about 80% of the refugees are women and children. The agency reports some 12,000 refugees have asked the government of Tanzania and the UN Refugee Agency for help to get home. IOM spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA the refugees believe their areas of origin are safe and they want to return to their homes in Burundi. He says he cannot assess potential dangers.
It's impossible to speculate on reprisals or anything else before we actually undertake the return, but community dialogue sessions with members of the host communities will be held in areas to where more people have returned. The dialogue sessions will include some job training and cash for work projects, and of course, instructions on gender-based violence and safeguards against trafficking.
On Thursday, the UN Migration Agency completed the first phase of this voluntary repatriation operation. A second phase of assisted returns is expected to begin in November and run until the end of the year. But Milman says $450,000 is needed to transport the many thousands who have voluntarily registered to return home from Tanzania. In addition, he says the IOM is appealing for more than $3 million to provide transportation, shelter, reintegration activities, and other essential assistance once the refugees have arrived in Burundi. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Donald Trump's travel ban on people from six mostly Muslim countries ends Sunday, and it's not clear what the administration's next step will be. The restrictions on visits by people from Somalia, Syria, Libya, Iran, Sudan, and Yemen triggered controversy and court challenges when introduced this year. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on the ban next month. The administration now is weighing a Department of Homeland Security report on security risks from a range of countries. Based on that report, the White House could extend the original 90-day travel ban. Also, some news reports indicate the White House might introduce more targeted restrictions for specific countries. The administration's 120-day ban on refugee arrivals expires next month. However, officials have signaled that after it expires, the U.S. will cut the number of refugees taken to under 50,000 a year. That's down from about 84,000 in 2016 and the lowest level since the 1980s.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Anti-government protests broke out today in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions. In Kenya, the same institution responsible for the failures in August's presidential poll is expected to organize a fresh vote in fewer than 5 weeks. And President Donald Trump's travel ban on people from six mostly Muslim countries ends Sunday, and it's not clear what the administration's next step will be. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane tells VOA that recent events in his country, including the assassination of the army's commander, Lieutenant General Koantele Matsumotso, are troubling to him both politically and personally.
The events that have taken place recently have saddened me a lot. I cannot hide the fact that I'm totally unhappy about the death of General Matsumotso. Because apart from being a soldier and a father and a citizen of the country, we had a certain understanding as people of just talking sometimes about our country outside the formalities of Minister of Defense and Commander of the Army. So his death has saddened me a lot, and it has affected me personally.
Thabane told VOA's Peter Cloete that he wants to talk to his political critics to find ways forward. Thabane, who was elected in June, also said he plans to focus on ending hunger in his country and providing education for children.
The leader of Libya's Presidential Council of the Government of National Accord says his country is making political and economic progress. In addressing the UN General Assembly this week, Fayez al-Sarraj called for more international support to continue that progress. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi has more.
Fayez al-Sarraj underscored the Presidential Council's goal of ensuring broad voter participation in Libya's elections next year. He said a successful vote is essential for ensuring a smooth transition and stabilizing the country.
The backdrop to any solution must remain a political one, and assistance will be needed for the presidential and parliamentary elections.
Since 2011, Libya has been engulfed in civil conflict that has devastated the economy. But As-Sarraj said the country now produces about 1 million barrels of oil a day. To encourage growth, he called for a resumption of international financial assistance, and he asked foreign governments to release Libyan financial assets abroad. Sarraj also asked for international support to resolve the migrant crisis in North Africa. He said no one country can tackle the issue alone.
A number of migrants enter the territory of my country and use it as a transit country on their way to Europe. Libya suffers just like other states from this. It's a burden on our already very limited budget and has a number of adverse security and economic consequences.
Sarraj warned the General Assembly that the war against terrorism is not over in Libya, even as progress is made in other parts of the region.
There are new hotbeds of tension and terrorism. They fled both Iraq and Syria and have come to our country. And we ask to be allowed to rebuild our army to ensure that we have an army which is able to face up to the terrorists and protect our country.
Sarraj said Libya has driven Islamic State fighters out of Sirte and other cities and thanked the U.S. for helping in that fight. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
The recent waves of migrants from Africa into Western Europe and the United States has many finance ministers concerned. They fear that the newcomers will drain their economies by taking jobs away from native-borns and receiving economic benefits from host countries. Migration is also seen as a failure of development in the home countries. But new research at the Center for Development casts both beliefs into doubt. In between sessions at UN headquarters this week, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with economist and study co-author Michael Clemens about the findings.
I think a lot of people who think about migration from Africa to other places think of it as a sign of failure, that there aren't enough jobs, there are not enough opportunities in the origin. And certainly that's true for many individual families. But as a broader part of the development of Africa, migration out of Africa is actually a sign of success. It's a sign of development success.
How so?
In various ways, in economic ways, when people have more disposable income, they can do things like invest in the education that gives them opportunities abroad. As poor countries develop towards middle-income countries, that is, as countries go from being, say, the income per capita of Malawi or Mali, more towards the income per capita of Botswana or Algeria, people get a lot more education. Investing in education of their children is one of the first things they do. And this not only gives people more opportunity to migrate, because the more education you have, the easier it is, but also in a broader sense, the aspiration to migrate. That is, the more access you have to high school and college education, the more you tend to look for the best place in the world that you could make your contribution. In a demographic sense, when people start to get higher incomes, they invest in things that prevent their children from dying, and the deaths of children before age 5 has been dropping like a rock across Africa for the last 20 years.
In other words, there's more people to migrate because there's more people.
Yes, there's a huge surge of young Africans into the labor market over the next 30 years.
What do you advise European governments to do or to think about policy-wise? Based on this idea that it's not necessarily bad news, it's the result of good news that all these migrants are coming in.
Policy efforts of Europe and many other places, certainly the United States, right now are very much focusing on limiting migration. Mm-hmm. And a lot more policy effort needs to be dedicated to innovation, to creating new ways for migration to happen that is mutually beneficial to the countries where migrants are going and the countries where they're leaving.
I suppose that you have some ideas about what some of these innovations might be or how people should think about it?
There are many, but one that I think is particularly promising is something we call global skill partnerships. For example, the Gambia, partnering with an employer, such as a nursing home in Germany, where the employer in the destination country agrees to provide finance, language training, and technical training in the Gambia before migration in return for service of potential migrants in Germany.
What's another idea?
But one of the leading examples of innovation in fostering migration for mutual benefit is in New Zealand. It's called the Recognized Seasonal Employer Program. This is an initiative of the New Zealand Aid Agency, and it increases the household income of typical participants in Tonga by 9 times, but not through taxing New Zealanders and giving it to people in Tonga. They come to New Zealand and work hard on farms. That grows the New Zealand economy, that adds value to the New Zealand economy, and the workers' share of that is $12,000 a year. That's just their share of the degree to which they've expanded the economy of New Zealand. They are sharing the benefits of migration between New Zealand and Tonga in a way that is fair and reasonable, doing more than many aid programs, but not at cost to anyone, by making the world economy larger.
Your report seems to imply that these sort of partnerships must arise in the coming decades.
Absolutely. By 2050, there will be 800 million more working age people in sub-Saharan Africa than there are now. It's just not possible that exactly the number of jobs that those 800 million kids need are going to exist in the countries where they come from. And that means we need to be preparing for a lot more migration. How can we turn them into a resource? How can we allow them to make the contribution that they could make rather than becoming a burden to anybody? They don't have to be.
Economist Michael Clemens is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips this week at UN headquarters in New York.
Today is World Rhino Day. It's commemorated every September 22nd to draw attention to the animals that are being threatened by poaching and the illegal trade of their horns. There are 5 species of rhinos. 3 are listed as being critically endangered: Black Sumatran and Javan. The Environmental Investigation Agency says there's been a dramatic escalation in poaching over the past decade. It says about 1,000 rhinos have been poached every year since 2013, up from just 13 in 2007. Poaching by criminal gangs is driven by the demand for the horns in Vietnam and China. About 1,500 rhino horns have been seized by authorities over the past 10 years in South Africa, China, Vietnam, Mozambique, and Namibia. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.